From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The verdict came in on Friday in the rape trial of the boy at St. Paul's, the New Hampshire prep school. A split verdict which in a lot of ways mirrors the way this society is still wrestling with sex, sexual freedom, sexual limits, coercion, and consensual sex on campuses in particular. This hour on Point, the St. Paul rape trial and the debate over what should be the standard for sexual consent. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What should the line be? Force? No means no. Yes means yes. And what should we be telling our sons and daughters? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Laura Dunn, executive and founder of Serve Justice, made a statement on Friday afternoon on behalf of the girl's family in reaction to the verdict last week.
Today, a measure of justice has been served for victims of sexual violence. While he was not convicted on all charges, Owen LaBrie was held accountable in some way by a jury of his peers for what he committed against our daughter. This conviction requires him to take ownership for his actions and gives him the opportunity to reflect upon the harm he has caused.
Owen LaBrie's defense attorney, J.W. Carney, right here.
He's not a saint. He's a teenager. But I submit he told you the truth from that stand.
What he said from the stand was no. He thought this was all right. In fact, there wasn't even full sex there. On Saturday on NBC's Today, Catherine Ruffle, one of the prosecutors in the St. Paul Prep School rape trial, said that the case speaks to the need for a conversation about sexual assault on campus and school in particular.
What's most important in this case is that there has been attention to this issue in regard to college campuses, and what this highlights is the need for these conversations and the issues to be addressed at the high school level and perhaps even middle school level.
Let's go first to Manchester, New Hampshire. On Friday, 19-year-old Owen LaBrie was convicted of four misdemeanors related to sexual assault and endangering the welfare of a child, one felony charge for using a computer to lure a minor, but not found guilty of felony sexual assault on other fronts. Dale Vincent joins us. She covers crime in the courts of the New Hampshire union leader. Dale, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. Hi.
Can you walk us through this verdict one more time here? It's confusing, I think, for a lot of people. What the jury found exactly?
Well, the jury seemed to be sort of split because they found him guilty of three misdemeanors, which included three variations on sexual assault, but they didn't find him guilty of that he was using force, which was the aggravated felonious sexual assault, sort of as if it was a consensual thing. But on the other hand, they did convict him of the felony, which will make him register as a sex offender for the rest of his life, unless, of course, he can get that overturned. So it was like they were saying, we think this happened. We think he wasn't telling the truth because he maintained that he had never had full sex. There'd never been any penetration, mm-hmm. and yet he was convicted of that, even if it sounds like it was could have been consensual. So it kind of a mixed message there.
Nine men, three women on this jury. From the testimony, is it clear why they would have struggled in this ambiguity?
Well, it may come down to the fact that when he appeared in court, we always joked he had the Harry Potter look. Dark hair, nicely cut, wore the Harry Potter glasses, even though it was 90 degrees, tweed jacket with leather patches on the elbows. But if you look at his mugshot, which is the Owen LaBrie that people saw at the school, his hair's a little longer, it's muffled or whatever, mm-hmm. He's got no glasses on, he's a little sunburned, and this is the captain of the soccer team, you know, the scholar, the all-A's kind of guy who is a really cool guy on campus. So they may have seen him as this nice young man, and he wouldn't have done it if she didn't let him. Whereas listening to that testimony and his friends talking about how he bragged about it, as a reporter, it was kind of like, he's being convicted of something that he said he didn't do, so they clearly thought he did it, but was she agreeable or not? And she couldn't be because she was only 15.
And, of course, there's this whole tradition, apparently, at St. Paul's of the senior salute, where seniors are supposed to rack up sexual conquest. His own attorney, J.W. Carney, again, talked about that in closing arguments of the trial last week.
For the boys, it was expected that they would be studs on this campus. You know, it was allowed to be about slaying, porking, scoring. And if you went out, you know, you were expected to be doing that. That was the measure of who you were as a boy.
The measure of who you were as a boy. What did the jury hear about the girl and, you know, no means no, yes means yes, how consent or the opposite or the lack of was expressed?
I think they had trouble with the fact that she admitted that she took her clothes off down to her underwear. They heard that she had told a roommate, a really close friend, that she would go to a certain point. She said at one point he was moving down her body and she grabbed his head and pulled it up and said, let's keep it up here, and also said no a couple of times. But whether that was lost or whether they didn't think she really meant it, you know, what's in the head of a juror, you can't be sure. But it would appear when she testified, and she did testify and was cross-examined kind of brutally at times over a couple of days, she said no, but she kind of froze at one point and didn't know how to do anything else, and it happened. And I guess maybe they figured, well, if she went that far, she probably didn't really want to say no, or maybe she wasn't really thinking no.
Here was the prosecutor. This was Joseph Chernisky telling the jury that he wouldn't take, LaBrie would not take no for an answer.
In his own words, he wanted to slay her. And on May 30th, 2014, he turned his lust for a 15-year-old girl into his reality.
Slay her, as in sex, in the parlance there, and more from the prosecutor here, saying it was a calculated decision to go for this.
He knew what he wanted to do once he got them there. And on the last night before graduation, nothing, not even a girl saying no, and holding on to her underwear was going to stop him.
Dale Vincent, what about the school itself? Is it liable here for some kind of civil charges from the family? Is there, have they said whether they may bring further legal action?
I don't know personally. There was one person testified, the dean of students, who testified they were aware of it at least last year.
Aware of it being the senior salute idea?
The senior salute and the fact that at one point the guys had their names on the back of a wall behind in the laundry room, and that was painted over, this dean said, Dean Green. And so then they went to Slayers Anonymous, I guess, online and were tallying their scores there. But they didn't say, we are going to make sure this never happens again, nor did he explain why they had just discovered it, if indeed they had, because this is an all-residential school, about 500 and some kids. Even the teachers live on campus. Even if you live in Concord, you have to live on campus. So it's a really closed society, and I cannot believe, to be honest, as a person, a human being, that the school just discovered this if it had been in practice for several years.
Fancy prep school in New Hampshire, but these issues come up all over the country. Dale Vincent is with the New Hampshire Union Leader and joined us from Manchester, New Hampshire. Dale, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, what do you think? Did the jury get it right here? And where should the bar be? 800-423-8255. Emily Bazelon joins us now from New Haven, Connecticut. Staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. She's been thinking and writing plenty about this and lots of issues around this case. Emily Bazelon, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What you wrote about this even before the verdict came down. What strikes you with the verdict that came down about the jury's deliberation and decision here?
I think the verdict makes clear that the jury was concerned about this girl's age. She was 15 at the time of the alleged incident, and Owen LaBrie was 18. And the misdemeanors he was found guilty of are misdemeanors that are tied to that age difference. So a lot of times we think of this as statutory rape. The computer charge, which carries the heaviest sentence, is also due to the age difference. It's, you know, the idea of luring or seducing a minor over the internet. I would question whether that kind of charge is really intended to be used against a high school student who was emailing someone he knew. It seems more like a kind of stranger danger law enacted to protect children against predators they don't know. But that was used by the prosecutors here. What the jury did not see was proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Owen LaBrie had sex with this girl against her consent. And I think, as Dale was just saying, the girl's own testimony might have created doubt in the jury's mind about how clear she was being. Because Owen LaBrie, in order to be convicted, had to know or reasonably should have known that she was not consenting. And I think that's the cloudy issue here. And that's why this case, in addition to the kind of fancy prep school setting, has generated a lot of debate.
I mean, where the bar is different around the country, and culturally it can be understood differently. Force is, in many states, is the legal bar for rape here. Then there's the idea of no means no, and lately people talking about yes means yes. Yes, the sort of, should we have a requirement of affirmative consent, and shy of that, you've got a legal problem. Where do you come down, Emily?
Well, on college campuses right now, you're right. There is this big debate going on about, is it enough to say that a woman usually says no? Or should we be requiring students to get to this yes means yes standard? Essentially, should we have them checking in with each other while they're having sex or leading up to sex to make sure that everybody is on board for everything that happens? And in the college context, I think educationally speaking, as a means of trying to get students to think about communicating and to think about how important it is to make sure you're with someone consensually, affirmative consent can be very useful. But whether it should be the legal standard for deciding criminal liability is a different question.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour, though it seems we shouldn't have to be, but anyway, talking about what is rape and what is and should be the standard for sexual consent after the New Hampshire prep school rape trial. Where should that bar be? No force, no means no, yes means yes. Emily Bazelon is with us. She's a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Her recent article was headlined, "The St. Paul's Rape Case Shows Why Sexual Assault Laws Must Change." You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins us from New Haven, Connecticut. Emily, what's the change that you and others are calling for when it comes to sexual assault laws, rape?
A lot of states still require prosecutors to show the use of force by a person accused of rape in order to win a conviction. And so that means that these cases don't simply turn on consent the way Owen LaBrie's case did. Instead, they turn on this additional element of showing that force was used.
So New Hampshire's actually, what, in a minority of states
that's right.
Force isn't the bar. It's a higher bar than that.
Exactly. And so in New Hampshire, this whole prosecution of Owen LaBrie was able to go forward because it was about consent. In a lot of states, he probably would not have been prosecuted at all for a felony. And so the question is, at this point in time, should we still have state laws requiring a rape victim, usually a woman, to show physical force was used in assaulting her? Or are we ready to move to consent, yes or no, as the question in rape cases like this one?
You cite Deborah Turkheimer at Northwestern University's School of Law. Deborah Turkheimer joins us right now from Chicago. Professor Turkheimer, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a little tour of the national landscape in terms of what states or regions the force is the standard, and where it's different, where it gets to consent of one kind or another?
Absolutely. In about half the states, maybe a bit more, as Emily mentioned, there is this force requirement, which means that the prosecutor has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt not just that the sex was without consent, but also that extra physical force was used, force beyond what's needed to accomplish non-consensual intercourse. And again, that's about half the states.
So if a victim says no all the way, but there wasn't active force, it wouldn't qualify as rape there.
That's right. And, this comes from this very, what I view as archaic and retrograde common law tradition that really viewed rape as a crime of physical violence, a crime of injury, a crime that took place between strangers, And in this modern era, I think understandings really have evolved. And that's why we see a trend in law reform across the country that seems to be taking hold in the direction of eliminating this force requirement and focusing on this question of consent.
So where would you put the bar, Deborah Turkheimer, at no? If a no is articulated, that has to be the end of it, and if not, it's rape? Or would you require active affirmative consent? Actually, a yes is necessary to make this legal?
Well, I think the easy question is whether force should be required, and on that I say no, that this really is about consent, and we should be talking about what consent looks like, and we should be educating our children about what sexual consent looks like, and that the national conversation should continue to move in the direction that we've seen it moving in these past few years. As far as the question of whether consent should be defined in affirmative terms or not, it's interesting to observe that on college campuses, you know, there's been this very emphatic move in the direction of that kind of standard. The idea is that passivity in and of itself does not indicate sexual consent. Whether this passivity is the result of extreme intoxication, whether the victim or alleged victim is asleep, whether she's fearful or frozen in fright, and these are all cases that I've looked at in the paper that you mentioned. If for any of those reasons the alleged victim is inert, she's passive, she does nothing to indicate non-consent, college students around the country, college activists are saying, that's not consent. That's not what consent looks like. Consent has to be active. Consent's got to be some kind of gesture, not necessarily verbal, but some kind of demonstration that this is wanted, that this is something that both participants or all participants are wanting to do. And I think that makes a lot of sense. It turns out that there are just a few states around the country that have that kind of law on the books, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if that's what we see in coming years, that sort of becomes the new forefront for understanding what consent looks like.
Let's look at these standards of no or an active yes. Emily Bazelon, I think I heard you say earlier, forgive me if I misunderstood this, it sort of surprised me, but I think I heard you say a woman usually says no. Did you say that? Is that what you meant?
No, I don't. I don't think I meant that, or at least I'm not sure what you mean.
I wasn't sure either, but I thought I heard you say those words, and I'm not. If the standard is no, then is that a flat standard? One no and it's over? One no that later becomes silence? I mean, Deborah says that we have to teach what consent looks like. Well, how does that get articulated?
That's a great question. I did some reporting on this last year on college campuses, and what I found is that some schools are really trying to get students to think through what is it? How do you know when someone wants to go do something with you? On the Yale campus where I happen to teach, there's a workshop in which students role play about asking each other to go out for frozen yogurt. And the point is that if you give someone instructions to say yes but seem reluctant, or say no but in a way that leaves the door open to a future invitation, students can actually pick up those nuances pretty easily. And then the question is whether that translates into the sexual context. And what I found in interviewing students was that there was a lot of concern about exactly how clear all this communication had to be, and a lot of fear, I think, that if they weren't good at talking about sex while they were having sex with someone or thinking about having sex with someone, that could kind of come back to haunt them, that they could be in trouble for being a kind of accidental rapist. And I think what that demonstrated to me talking to these students is that we're in the middle of a cultural shift, and we need to give it some time to play out. We need to give young people some time to get better at all of this and to kind of catch up with this cultural standard, which seems like it should be so black and white and so clear. You know, as we know, sex is complicated and has a lot of ambiguities in it, and I think the kids' responses are reflecting that.
Emily, stand by. Deborah Turkheimer in Chicago. Anita is calling from Chesapeake, Virginia. Anita, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I feel so sorry for this young man. I think his counsel misrepresented him by changing his appearance. But I do believe in this era that all men should have verbal consent on their handheld devices.
Wait, you feel sorry for the young man in this case, Anita? Why?
I do, because he's a young man and this will carry him forever, number one. Number two, my mother told me when I was 12, never tease. She was 15 and she's mourning the loss of her virginity, but she was quite on board with this. I'm a woman. I have been there. And I feel sorry for him. And I feel sorry
you think
for
the girl in New Hampshire was quite on board, but she's that's not what she's saying. She's saying she wasn't. And
that's not what she's saying, but I followed this. She was quite on board with this. She's mourning the loss of her virginity, but this young man will pay for this for the rest of his life. Parents need to ask their young men, please get verbal consent over the phone, whether you're a teenager or you're a grown man.
What do you mean over the phone, Anita? You mean make a recording of it?
Make a recording of it, because women could always say rape. And I was attacked. I was almost raped. So I know what I'm saying. Women should always say yes on something. You can't even get it in writing, because then you'll have to prove their signature. So get a verbal consent on some type of device.
Anita, let me pick it up, if I may, with Emily and Deborah. Deborah Turkheimer, is that where we're headed? Get an on-microphone or on-video consent before you get in there. Is that realistic?
Well, it's not realistic, and it's not where we're headed. It's easy to caricature these affirmative consent requirements, but that's not how this is going to play out. In fact, and let's go back to the New Hampshire case. New Hampshire is not an affirmative consent jurisdiction. New Hampshire prohibits penetration when, at the time of the sexual assault, the victim indicates by speech or conduct that there's not freely given consent to the performance of the sexual act. So if indeed this girl said no repeatedly, and the jury believed that and considered this proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that would seem to satisfy the standard. Now, this case was complicated, and this case was difficult, and there were issues of credibility and issues of proof that made this case a challenge. But I'm going to go back to something Emily said and reiterate that I think this is the kind of case that that should be litigated, and rather than look to the use of force and how much force was used to overcome the victim's will, you know, this is what we should be centering the conversation on.
Was there evidence or testimony that indicated enough force in this case that in the other states that you've surveyed, Professor, this would even have come to trial in a force standard state?
No. No, it wouldn't. And you know, prosecutors have to take legally sufficient cases forward. And so in a jurisdiction that requires this kind of extra physical force beyond what's needed for non-consensual penetration, then this case is nothing, or maybe the misdemeanors, but I think it's unlikely that a prosecutor would have brought this forward.
Emily, that's kind of incredible. In New Hampshire, this was a full-fledged case. It was a big case. It got a lot of attention, and elsewhere around the country wouldn't even have come to trial.
Right. I think it's also important to think about how this case came to trial and also the issues of punishment it raises. So we know from the local reporting that Owen LaBrie was offered a plea bargain before trial in which he would have pled guilty to simple assault. He wouldn't have had to register as a sex offender, which he is now going to have to do.
For life.
And he wouldn't. For life, and he wouldn't have faced prison time.
Which he does up to 11 years here, I'm reading, potentially.
Exactly.
Though it could be
known. Right. It could be. But we're talking about potentially hefty punishments. And lifetime registration as a sex offender is a big deal. I mean, your caller's right that this will affect this young man for the rest of his life. So he made a gamble that the jury would believe him when he said that he didn't have sex with this girl. There was physical evidence suggesting that he did. And so I think the implausibility of his claim about that then made him very vulnerable to the charges about whether they had had sex at all. And these charges, as I said earlier, were based on her age, the fact that she was 15. So that, I think, is part of understanding the whole here. And then the second question is one of punishment. You know, given that LaBrie was convicted essentially of statutory rape, is time in prison really appropriate for him? Or lifetime registry as a sex offender? Are those overly harsh punishments for someone who was convicted in the way that he was?
Professor Turkheimer, what do you think of the way this verdict eventually played out, came out?
Well, I do think that the case has catapulted this conversation, and it's such an important one. But you know, it's a fact that most of these cases that make their way to criminal court do not involve such young adults, or such kids in mm-hmm. many respects. And I think that's important to remember too. I mean, we can take the facts of this case and we can parse them, and we can focus on the St. Paul's case as emblematic of many of the problems that we're seeing on college campuses and maybe even high school campuses. But, you know, the standard, whatever standard we're going to have in place to deal with the problem of sexual assault is a standard that impacts adults as well. And I think that's an important point here.
Kate in Dayton, Ohio. Kate, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a few things. You know, I'm a parent. I have 3 children under the age of 6, so mm-hmm. they're still very young. But I have 2 girls and a boy.
Okay.
And, you know, this is something that I think about both for my girls and my son. You know, consent has to be no means no. You know, both for my girls, it concerns me that, you know, they said that this young lady in this case, you know, stripped down to her underwear, and so then maybe she didn't really mean no. I don't care if my daughters are standing naked in front of someone. If they decide that they don't want to do this anymore and they say no, that should be the end of it. And that's what I'm going to teach my son, too. I don't care how far it's gotten. If the girl says no, that means you stop.
And if the boy doesn't stop, is that rape? In your view, Kate?
Yeah. In my case, non-consensual penetration is rape. The use of force, I believe all states should go to a non-use of force law on this, because that no means no. And we continue to blame the victim in these cases across the country. You know, I don't care, again, I don't care if she strips down to her underwear by her own hand. When she said no, no meant no, and that should have been the end of it.
Kate, I appreciate your call. Deborah Turkheimer, is that the standard you're advocating?
Well, at the very least, yes, and maybe even beyond that. I mean, I think that the affirmative consent standards that we've talked a little bit about have a lot to recommend them insofar as they take this passivity that again we see in far too many cases. I mean, it's very sad that there are these categories of cases where for any number of reasons the victim or alleged victim is not doing anything. And then the question is, what is the legal meaning of that passivity? Does that count as consent? And in the cases that I've looked at, I just don't see it. And so whether the cultural evolution that we've talked some about has advanced to the point where we can codify affirmative consent in the criminal law more broadly, I think is an open question. But is that the direction that I think we should be going? Yes.
And Emily, you've talked about on campus, but is there any reason that the law should be different on campus than anywhere else in the country?
Well, you could argue for a difference because on campus, if you are being investigated by the university and the potential consequence is discipline, suspension, or expulsion, you could have a different standard than in the criminal law, right? So expulsion is a serious punishment. I take it really seriously as a consequence for students. It's not the same thing, though, as going to prison. So one way to think about this is you could try an affirmative consent standard on campus before you think about imposing that in the context of committing a crime and going to jail.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what is, what should be, the standard for sexual consent after the New Hampshire prep school rape trial. No force, no means no, or even more, yes means yes, affirmative consent.
Emily Bazelon is with us, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, joins us from New Haven, Connecticut. Deborah Turkheimer is with us from Chicago, professor at Northwestern University School of Law. And we've got people writing all kinds of response online here. One of them, Hello Kitty, says, I can't believe Tom is even asking what consent is. No means no, end of story. But we're hearing today from Deborah Turkheimer's research that in more than half the states in this country, that is, in fact, legally not the case. Without force, it's not rape. In New Hampshire, that is the case. But beyond that, many states, it's not the case. And now there's this new standard being raised of yes means yes, affirmative consent. I want to dive further into that. John Banzhaf joins us. John Banzhaf III, professor of law, George Washington University, joins us from Washington now. John Banzhaf, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. I'm glad you covered two of these so-called sleeper issues. One is the need to put a Romeo and Juliet provision in the computer solicitation law, and also the possibility not only of suing St. John's as a school, but that under civil law, all of the boys who participated in the so-called senior salute could be sued. And that, in the long run, may make more of a difference than whether or not this one guy is prosecuted or what he gets.
What's a Romeo and Juliet provision? You would carve that out so that young people could talk online, and even if they were on opposite sides of the age of consent, and not be risking charges?
Exactly. Just as we have in the age of consent statute in Connecticut and most states, if they're within 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years of each other, it is either not a crime or a less serious crime. But the big thing that you guys have been not talking about is how can we really prevent rape? We now know from a New England Journal of Study how we can slash rape, at least on college campuses, by 50%. We're not doing it. And a lot of the discussion about consent is really irrelevant because in most of the cases, the parties are drunk. In 60% of the cases, the women do not remember what happened. And therefore, whether it's yes means yes or no means no or whatever, it doesn't make much difference. You also have to realize that yes means yes, number one, doesn't really work in practice. Number two, has not been shown to reduce rapes. And perhaps most importantly, it was just held unconstitutional as a violation of due process.
Well, but if alcohol is a factor here, wouldn't that make affirmative consent very much an active factor if that were the law of the land? Because if you're drunk, you can't give affirmative consent.
Wrong.
Okay.
In most states, the law is you must be totally incapacitated, which means you are unable to walk or talk or communicate. The mere fact that you're intoxicated doesn't mean you cannot give consent. Think back, if you will, to those Girls Gone Wild commercials. The girls came in and sued. They said, well, I wouldn't have shown off my breasts and allowed it to be videotaped and put on the, well, not on the internet at the time, but on videotapes, unless I was drunk. And the judge said, well, yeah, but you got drunk. Your consent is still valid. So the mere fact that people are intoxicated, that they would fail a DWI test, doesn't mean they cannot give consent in any of these states that I'm aware of.
Bridget in Atlanta, Georgia. Bridget, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What's your experience?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I went to the University of Georgia, and I was sexually assaulted by one of my really good friends, and I actually didn't find out until a few days later when other friends started teasing me for having slept with this person, and it was humiliating, and it has ruined a lot of friendships, and it's affected my marriage now.
Bridget, I'm sorry for it, Bridget, but how could it happen? Were you drunk? Was that the issue?
Yeah, it was Mardi Gras at UGA in Athens, Georgia, and I just didn't remember anything, literally, until days later when people told me. And that's how I found out that I had been sexually assaulted.
With that experience,
very much.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Let me just, if I may, Bridget, with that experience behind you, how do you find yourself? And we can hear that you're still emotionally charged by it. I understand that. But how do you find yourself thinking about this consent conversation now?
I hear about the apps that people are creating about, you know, get it on tape and things like that, and I just don't think that is enough, because I'm sure that I consented. I'm sure I did, but I didn't mean it, you know? And so I think it's a big education piece. So we need to start teaching our kids at a really, really young age what it means, because college, if you're teaching it in college, it's already too late. They already have their ideas in their head of what they're going to do and how they should behave around women.
Bridget, you hang in there. You can be okay. You're going to be fine. And if I may, John, I want to bring Deborah in just for a moment here to this issue of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
What about affirmative consent and alcohol? Bridget calls and says, you know what, I may very well have consented under the influence of alcohol.
Yeah, these are really tough issues. I think we need to distinguish between levels of intoxication. So there's intoxication that impairs judgment. And, you know, no one is suggesting that that sort of intoxication is inconsistent with the giving of consent. And, you know, I think that raises all sorts of separate issues, right, as to alcohol training and education on college campuses. It's important, but it's not what we're talking about, I think, when we're dealing with the criminal law.
But John those says, look, if girls gone wild couldn't...
Those cases involve intoxication to the point of incapacitation. And in the cases that I reviewed, that's exactly the kind of evidence that came in at trial, that this was someone who was unconscious, who was passed out, who was acted upon. In those cases, the affirmative consent standard is really important because it clarifies that that's not consent. That's not what sexual consent looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And
John?
That's exactly why the court held that it was unconstitutional to place the burden of proof in a case involving in Tennessee where both of them were too drunk to remember. The court said you can't require the boy to prove that he was innocent. By the way, what Bridget described is exactly what was thrown out in a court in another court in Washington. And Tom, you're not giving me as a one male.
Hang on a second.
I'm the one male panelist, and you're not giving me anywhere near equal time. The Bridget situation is another one which was just thrown out by a court in Washington, Washington Lee case. It's called regret rape. It's where the woman agrees to the rape. Several days later, after her friends have pressured her or whatever, she regrets it, and suddenly it becomes non-consensual. Again, it doesn't make any difference what the standard is if they're too drunk to remember. We know what does it. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine showed how we can slash rapes on campus by a full 50%. It has nothing to do with consent, but nobody's doing it.
Well, are you being mysterious about what this is, John? What?
No, I'm perfectly happy to tell you. What it said is that many college women are perfectly able and capable of saying no, don't, and so on very forcefully, effectively, and vigorously when the male is a stranger. But when it is a friend or an acquaintance, then they are reluctant to do it. And as a result, they get mixed signals. No means no doesn't work. It didn't work in Connecticut. She was relying upon this no means no manta. They still found that she had consented. And by the way, in the St. Paul's case, she says, I wanted to not cause a conflict.
So what's the miracle solution that you're still not articulating, though you've mentioned it several times?
A training program in which women are trained or encouraged to speak out forcefully and effectively when the person is an acquaintance or a date, the same way they would as if he was a stranger. It's slashed at 50%. We also believe that if we had more education about the dangers of intoxication, binge drinking, that it would reduce sex crimes. But the federal government refuses to allow that. Well, doesn't say you can't do it. It says it won't fund it, which is exactly the same thing. So on most campuses, what we're doing is we're having programs that say, don't rape or intervene if you see a rape. But we don't do that when bicycles are stolen. We don't say, don't steal bicycles. We don't encourage kids to intervene when you see a bicycle stolen. With bicycles, we teach people how to lock it up securely. With regard to date rape, we should be encouraging women to speak forcefully and effectively, and obviously not to get into a situation where they are totally incapacitated.
Deborah Turkheimer, is a strong no, shouldn't it be more or less as good as an affirmative yes? We're drawing a line.
I think that, you know, in most instances, it turns out that women are perfectly able to communicate their desires using all sorts of language, verbal and nonverbal. And, you know, these aren't the cases that are sort of coming to the fore as problematic, as cases involving someone who feels violated. Those are the cases that we're talking about. So, you know, if somebody is asleep, if somebody is passed out, if somebody has been beaten in the past and is very afraid, these are cases where that makes the no more difficult. But of
those
course,
are not the cases being
cases.
Brought in court. There's two dozen cases where the guys have gone to court and the courts have sided with the men. The women weren't unconscious. They hadn't been beaten. There were problems of communication, and the courts threw it out And I think that's the bottom line. Eventually, the courts are going to step in here, as they're increasingly doing. They're going to set the standard. And when they set the standard based on constitutional grounds, that trumps whatever the states do and whatever the schools do.
Emily Bazelon, you wrote about all of this in your recent column, but it seemed to me that you didn't end up expressing your own view of affirmative consent. Is it realistic? Is it time to go there? How do you look at it, Emily?
I don't think it's realistic to go there now in terms of criminal law. I worry that that's imposing too high a standard, and I want to give affirmative consent standards on campuses a chance. Let's try there where the stakes are somewhat lower and see how they shake out, and also to see how the cultural conversation changes.
But Emily, they haven't worked on any campus that I'm aware of. Are you aware of any where they have a study showing that when they did it a year or two ago, that it reduced rapes like the New England Journal study did?
As you know, studies take a long time and research takes a while. I don't think we have evidence one way or the other about whether affirmative consent is an effective, helpful policy on campuses or not. I do think the New England Journal study you pointed to is important. And the Canadian program you were talking about, you're right. It does talk about encouraging women to speak up for themselves more strongly. And that is an interesting finding and one that schools should be considering as they are putting together rape prevention efforts.
John, why are you apparently set against affirmative consent? Do you think it's not realistic? Do you think it's unfair to men? What's the heart of your opposition?
It's totally unrealistic and unnecessary. A simple actual case I consulted on. A guy was convicted because the boy and the girl had been having sex for a long time. One night, he forgot to ask for her consent. They expelled him. When I got into the case, I asked about the facts. It turned out the first thing which had happened is she had performed fellatio on him. Turned out she didn't ask either. So now she can be charged because she didn't get his affirmative consent. So both of them are molesting each other. This makes no sense.
Deborah?
Yes. I want to clarify that on campus and off campus, the burden of proof remains on either the university or the state. If this is a criminal prosecution, the Tennessee case I referred to earlier was a case where the chancellor had misinterpreted the relevant provision. But in fact, regardless of what the standard is, the prosecution has the burden of proof, and that's for very good reasons. The other thing I want to point out is that the criminal law has a rule that says reasonable mistakes matter. And so I think some of the concerns expressed with respect to affirmative consent might be alleviated by sort of acknowledging that there is this outlet, there's this pressure valve, there's this ability for the jury, if it comes to a jury, to weigh in and to decide, was it reasonable for this defendant, this individual, to believe that there was consent when, in fact, maybe there wasn't, right? And so this is really important, too, that the criminal law, can be a very blunt instrument, but it also has these places where some of the worries that have been expressed, I think, can sort of resolve themselves and give us some comfort that the kinds of prosecutions going forward will be just prosecutions.
Are we at a place
actually,
culturally,
up in Harvard, two dozen professors said the burden of proof at Harvard, which doesn't even have affirmative consent, is on the guy and not on the woman. So that isn't necessarily true unless you think two dozen Harvard law professors are all wrong.
Deborah Tuckheimer, are we at the place culturally where sex is a matter of such open conversation that everybody who, even if they want to go forward, that they're going to be ready and willing to say yes? I mean, we've got a cultural history where, and this could be deeply abused, but where no could be a prelude to yes. Or, are we at the place now where men, women are so comfortable in talking about this that they can sit down and say, all right, yes, let's do this?
Well, I think in an ideal world, maybe there would be a conversation, but that, again, is not what's necessary under these affirmative consent standards. What's needed is some demonstration, indication, manifestation of a willingness to go forward, and there are all sorts of ways for that to happen. I do think our sexual mores have changed a lot, and again, whether we're at the point now where we can codify affirmative consent across the board, I think is an open question. I don't have the answer to that. But do I think we're moving in that direction as a society? I do.
Emily, Deborah's research shows us that we're getting spread out across quite a wide range here now of standards, though, where force is still the the measure of rape in so many states, while at the same time we're talking about needing affirmative consent. There's a long distance between those two.
Right. And so what you can see here is a cultural shift that the country has not made its mind up about. I mean, I think the force requirements that Deborah has rightly pointed to as problematic are left over. These states are lagging behind. It can take legislators a while to change the law. The affirmative consent debate is a very new one, and that's the one that we are watching play out on college campuses. And as you know, I think this conversation has made clear, there is a lot of disagreement and very fraught passion about exactly who is at risk, men or women, people who complain or people who are accused.
Emily Bazelon with the New York Times Magazine, thank you so much for joining us this hour. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Deborah Turkheimer at Northwestern University School of Law. Professor Turkheimer, thank you for coming on.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
And John Banzhaf at the George Washington University, Professor of Law there. Professor Banzhaf, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for the short amount of time I got.
I think you made the most of it. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.